Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach, KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that the opinions expressed on any public affairs show do not reflect those of KX93.5, its management, or the board of directors.
Bringing to you the voices, policies, and positions of trailblazers and leaders from Laguna Beach, Orange County, and all across the great state of California, you are listening to Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson on Laguna's own KX93.5 FM.
Welcome to Laguna Roundtable. I'm Ari Grayson. On behalf of the World Affairs Council of Orange County, I'd love to welcome my guest, Dr. Greg Daddis. Dr. Daddis is an associate professor of history and director of Chapman University's MA program in War and Society. Dr. Daddis joined Chapman University after having served as the chief of American History Division in the Department of History at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Retired U.S. Army Colonel, Dr. Daddis served our nation in both Operations Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom. Thank you for joining me today.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Before we begin, I'd like to thank you for your lifetime of service defending our nation, helping to provide military knowledge and context to the next generation of leaders coming out of West Point, and to your continuing service in educating students and the public about issues related to war and peace.
Thank you.
Let's start with this. The cornerstone of American foreign policy has long been stability, predictability, and credibility. Mm-hmm. You recently wrote an article, American Credibility in the Age of Trump. Donald Trump ran for presidency touting his approach to foreign policy as being one of unpredictability.
Right.
If you would, please, can you explain whether this type of approach is strategic and positive, or is Mr. Trump confusing unpredictable with erratic, and therefore a style that's ill-conceived, destabilizing, and potentially dangerous?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, probably the latter. I think, you know, clearly at the tactical and operational level, the unpredictability against your enemy is something to be valued. But I think at the grand strategic and national security level, that predictability is actually a positive for both your allies and your adversaries. And my concern in writing the piece for the National Interest was that we take as a matter of faith that we should employ military force overseas simply for the fact of maintaining our credibility. And we never really go beyond that. We don't define what credibility means. We don't make a strong argument to the public about why we're using military force to maintain that sense of credibility. And I think that's a problem because I think in a sense that the policymakers who are representing us and using force on our behalf are in a sense getting a pass, that they're just saying, well, we have to maintain a presence here. We have to use military force because if we don't, we won't be seen as credible. And so I think it's certainly problematic. And I think what you also see, and this isn't unique to President Trump, is that oftentimes I think presidents of the United States conflate the nation's prestige and credibility with their own credibility. So if they fail to act, it's not just the nation that will suffer, but their own sense of self will suffer. And so I think that's certainly a problem, I think, especially with somebody like Mr. Trump, who I think tends to take things personally, obviously, I think has a hard time separating out policy disagreements from personal slights, that's problematic, I think, in terms of constructing a long-term foreign policy, which we have a difficult time doing anyway because we're just on the short domestic election time schedule. So that makes the construction and establishment of a long-term foreign policy even more difficult in our democracy.
How do our enemies also benefit by knowing that we're credible and predictable?
Well, I think you can look at it two ways. I think that an adversary like Russia, knowing that we will be predictable in certain cases, is not necessarily a bad thing. That depends on our self-interests and the relation of those self-interests to larger, I think, hopefully national ideals. And foreign policy should be a combination of both self-interest and ideals. So I think, you know, having some sense of constancy in how you approach foreign policy is not necessarily a negative in terms of your adversaries, that if they see that you're strong and this is where your interests lie, that's not a bad thing. And it doesn't necessarily give them advantage. Again, and I think what we need to do is separate out credibility and constancy at the, or predictability and constancy at the higher levels with that at the tactical and operational levels. It's clearly at the, on the battlefield, it's good to be unpredictable and to gain an element of surprise and advantage over your enemy. But at the grand strategic level, I think predictability for both your adversaries and your allies is probably something that's a little bit more desirable.
Doesn't it also provide a stabilizing force?
I think so, right? I think if you're clear about where you see your interests and your commitments, that it allows, I think, you to, in a sense, also have some flexibility, right? That if you're not worried about trying to continually refashion the message based on erratic behavior,
right,
that I think it allows those that are implementing that foreign policy to do so knowing that they've got a clear objective in mind. And I think we've seen that over the last 2 years in particular being somewhat problematic.
Well, I would think certainly that predictability would also include knowing where red lines are drawn and where not to cross them.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, clearly we saw with President Obama the use of that phrase, the red line, venture to say he'd probably like to take that back.
Oh, no doubt, certainly, because when President Obama decided not to intervene in Syria after the nation's dictator Bashar al-Assad crossed an American red line using chemical weapons, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta asserted that Obama's failure was damaging because it hurt the credibility of the United States, and our credibility was certainly on the line.
Yeah, and but I think the question for us now is 2-3 years after that, 4 years after that, to look back on Panetta's assertion and question that. Did we really lose any credibility as a global power based on President Obama saying this was a red line, the Syrian leader crossed it, and then we failed to act in at least according to some, as an inappropriate manner? Did our credibility truly suffer? And I'm not so sure it did. We saw the same thing happen in the Vietnam War, where there was all these concerns about the United States losing its credibility if it left Vietnam without, in President Nixon's phrase, peace with honor. And I don't think we achieved peace with honor. And I'm not so sure that our credibility as a global power was irreparably damaged based on that withdrawal.
Recently, we saw that Donald Trump proclaimed that Bashar al-Assad of Syria and Vladimir Putin of Russia, as well as strongman Erdogan of Turkey, could basically have Syria to themselves because the U.S., in Donald Trump's word, had won the battle and we were leaving Syria. We were leaving that, according to President Trump, ISIS has been defeated.
Right.
What are American interests in Syria? And why should the American people put their treasure and their lives of its children on the line for that nation?
I think that's a central question that we just quite simply are not asking our policymakers to answer. And I think one of the problems that I would argue we've had in terms of post-9/11 debates over foreign policy and national security are asking some of those central questions about what are our interests, what are the cost benefits of using force in a certain area, what existential interests do we have in the Middle East? Are we there doing more harm than good by our presence? I think if you at least read the missives coming out of Al-Qaeda prior to 9/11, it was our presence in and of itself in the Middle East that was kind of causing a backlash and this resentment that ultimately led to some of the actions in 9/11. And again, I just don't think we're having a hard enough discussion about those central questions. I think for Syria, I would question Mr. Trump's assertion that we have defeated ISIS. We've clearly had issues with this before. We've defeated the National Liberation Front in Vietnam, pejoratively known as the Viet Cong. We've defeated the Taliban. We've defeated Al Qaeda. We've defeated ISIS, and never quite seemed to actually achieve a long-term sense of accomplishment or success. So I think that's the other challenge as well, is creating objectives that actually are achievable. And I think we've been having a hard time with that over arguably the last few decades.
Well, isn't it somewhat like a cancer where even a few cells left can kind of reconstitute
right,
the
exactly.
threat, metastasize, right. break off, and then we see
which is exactly what ISIS is. Right,
it's a
reformulation of an old threat.
Right, and it does seem to me to be a fairly accurate metaphor there for you know what we're seeing with Al-Qaeda and what's happened with them.
Mm-hmm.
We as a nation and Western civilization in general are facing threats, it seems to me, like we've never seen before. There are certainly bad actor states such as Russia, Syria, and Iran, and there are evil organizations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah. Given our broad cultural disdain for war, how should we be approaching these kinds of threats, threats that may require not just a commitment of military personnel for years, but perhaps even decades?
Well, first off, I may push back about this idea that we're in this grave moment of history where there are evil threats behind every door. I think if you go back and take a longer view of our national security strategies going back from the end of the Cold War to today, I mean, almost every national security strategy, regardless of president, starts out with, we are in one of the most dangerous times in world history, which I think is just a code word to say, make sure our defense spending is where it needs to be. I think one of the questions we need to ask first is, as we determine these threats, how capable are they of projecting true power abroad? So clearly we saw with 9/11 that there was a small capacity to sustain damage to the United States and take American lives. But how capable are these threats of actually projecting true power abroad? I think secondly, I think what we have to start looking at is a way to stop looking at the symptoms of violence and more at the causes, which may then require us to think less from a military standpoint about problem solving overseas and more from social, diplomatic, economic, education aspect. I think far too often, especially in the aftermath of World War II, we've kind of militarized our foreign policy. And so when we determine threats and the responses to those threats, we too often look at them through a military lens without thinking more deeply about the causes of violence. We just look at the symptoms of violence and how can we tamp down those symptoms. And so I think, to me, one of the things we have to do is break this cycle of militarization in our foreign policy thinking and get to a point where we're looking at, again, the causes of violence rather than the outcomes of that violence. And I think we're not doing all that good of a job at it. Just look at the budgets for the State Department and the Department of Defense for the last decade plus, right? It demonstrates, if you just follow the money, it demonstrates that our commitment and our priorities are more on the militarization and militarized aspects of foreign policy rather than the diplomatic, social, economic, political. And I think If you don't kind of flip that script, then you are committing yourself to this, what you mentioned, generational warfare. And I'm not so sure that that's how we should be thinking about foreign policy. And because then you are truly committing yourself, I think, then to occupation of foreign lands for decades, if not longer. And you are basically saying that this is truly an American empire that is managing holdings overseas. I'm just not so sure that that's in our best interest for the long term.
Well, it would certainly seem to me that the investment in diplomacy pays tremendous dividends compared to the cost of war, and both in a financial and a human toll.
Right.
So having that first option being diplomatic resolution would certainly seem to be the wise route to go. Unfortunately, it appears at this time that we've gutted much of our diplomatic corps, and unfortunately, that's not the first approach that we seem to take.
Right.
Perhaps the singular defining characteristic of Donald Trump's foreign policy is America first.
Mm-hmm.
What role do our European allies and our strategic alliances, speaking of diplomacy,
right,
play in our country's military success and our diplomatic successes?
I think they're one and the same. And I think an American first rhetoric is not helpful in terms of promoting American interests. And I also think it's out of step with with modern era, going back to the openings of the 20th century, if not much earlier, that we have always been part of a globalized society. Even going back to the French-Indian Wars and then the American Revolution, that the United States has always been part of a globalized society. And so this rhetoric of America first that dismisses alliances and doesn't think about the global interconnectivity in terms of getting groups of nations that are like-minded, that have roughly similar values, that have roughly similar interests, I just don't think is in line with the reality of our globe today. And I think that trend of globalization has just increased exponentially, obviously, with technology and mass communication and obviously the internet. Now, that doesn't mean that as you're working with alliances that you're not working with your self-interests in line. No president, regardless of party, is going to succeed without putting the interests of the United States first and foremost. But I don't think that those national priorities have to be separated out from the priorities of working with and through allies.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you're listening to Perspectives with Dr. Ari Grayson. My guest today is Dr. Greg Dattis. Dr. Dattis is the director of Chapman University's MA program in War and Society. He served as the chief of American History Division in the Department of History at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. NATO was formed in the aftermath of World War II, ostensibly as a deterrent to Soviet aggression. What, if any, role do you believe NATO should play today in our global arenas to defend and protect the sovereign European nations that constitute its membership?
I don't know if the basic aims of NATO have changed from its inception. Again, it's an organization of like-minded nations, again, who share similar values. The fact that the Soviet Union has collapsed as an ideological threat in the aftermath of the Cold War doesn't mean that NATO is still a worthwhile entity to be working together as partners, to be expanding basic values, whether American values or values of the alliance, and as a force for maintaining stability. All these things, I think, are necessary, again, not just from a values-based foreign policy, but also from a self-interest one as well, that the United States operates best in a global economy when that global economy is stable. And I think strong alliances like NATO help maintain that stability. And again, I think that works quite well in terms of its original vision, and I think it can continue to work well in the future with our participation.
In the mid-1980s, the U.S. 7th Fleet patrolled the Persian Gulf to protect the Straits of Hormuz while a bloody war was raging between Iraq and Iran. Mm-hmm. Our naval fleet was there to ensure the uninterrupted flow of oil coming from the great bastion of democratic ideals, dictator Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Mm-hmm. To what degree does our dependence on something as vital to our economy as foreign oil, how does that shape American foreign policy?
Far too much. And I think it's something we've been struggling with, obviously, for decades. I think one of the best books on this subject came out a few years ago by Andrew Bacevich, a professor emeritus at Boston University. He was a former Army officer, and I think has written some of the most insightful works on modern American foreign policy. And he came out with a book on America's wars in the greater Middle East and suggests just that this over-dependency on oil has kind of straitjacketed our foreign policy and narrowed our choices in terms of how we look at the region. So, you know, we saw this debate, I think, during the Obama administration, and I think we should kind of return to it, that when you look at energy independence, that clearly I think there are environmental benefits to that. But I also think that there are national security implications as well, that the ability to wean ourselves off of dependence of Middle Eastern oil, which I think we've certainly done more so over the last few decades, I think will allow us to be more flexible in our foreign policy. Now, you know, we've sort of weaned ourselves off of Middle Eastern oil dependency. Of course, I think we still have to look at how other nations and allies rely on Middle Eastern oil, and that, again, is something that should be concerning to us in terms of conceptualizing foreign policy. But I think having some more sense of energy independence as a nation will allow us to have more flexibility in terms of how we approach the Middle East. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing at all.
Absolutely. And certainly here in California, Governor Newsom has set forth a policy that our state, at least, will be 100% renewable energy in just 26 years, by 2045. So hopefully that will give us a tremendous amount of flexibility across our nation.
Yeah, and I don't think we... You know, one of the things we do here at Chapman with the War and Society program is take a look at the relationships between war and society in a holistic manner. And you know, one of the former Joint Chiefs of Staff said as he was leaving that the environment was a clear national security issue. And I think, again, one of those conversations that we should be having is taking a look at how the environmental changes are and having an impact on our national security and having an impact on global security as well.
Well, much of the world's history has obviously been tainted by war and conflict. Mm-hmm. However, the battlefields seem to have broadened. Battlefields today are not only physical with bullets and bombs assaulting human flesh, they're also virtual with democratic institutions and processes that are being attacked and eviscerated. Yeah. What are the greatest threats to our nation at this point and our people today? How do we defend against them?
I think we need to start having a more public debate about how we define war in the modern era. And at what point does a cyber attack move from an economic attack or to something that constitutes an act of war. And I think we're kind of struggling with that in terms of how we respond. If you think about some of the debates we've had recently about American unit deployments to Poland as a response to Russian aggression, not just on the ground, but also through the use of cyber attacks, that there seems to be a mismatch there, right? That we're looking at deploying physical units to Eastern Europe as a response to Russian cyber attacks. There seems to be a mismatch there in terms of a response. So I think we need to start having a more open debate about how the very concept of war is changing in this era. And I think that... you know, when you look at least some of the implications and the allegations coming out of our most recent election and the possibility of a foreign state actually having a no kidding influence on the election outcome, it seems like it constitutes something more than simply an attack. And if we're responding in an old fashioned way by moving troop units around, it seems like we might be falling a step behind in terms of conceptualizing what the relationships are between war and society in this modern era.
Well, speaking of attacks, and presumably you mean from Russia in the 2016 election and potentially ongoing attacks, according to some of our intelligence services, well, certainly former President Ronald Reagan understood the duplicitous nature of the old Soviet Union and the great heir to that, Vladimir Putin, today. Mm-hmm. Former President Reagan proclaimed trust but verify, right. And he used it frequently when discussing U.S. relations with the Soviet Union. Now we have a president who says that he asked Vladimir Putin, a former colonel and intelligence officer in the Soviet Union's KGB, if Russia interfered in U.S. elections. And President Trump proclaimed that there's no reason to doubt Russia's denials because Putin denied them very strongly.
Right.
Why should or shouldn't the American people accept those denials given the fact that they were so vehemently denied by Vlad Putin?
I think they shouldn't accept them because we don't have any evidence right now that to accept the president's statements. I think the implication behind President Reagan's rightful assertion of trust but verify means that you have to have evidence to verify compliance. And I think when you have a president that is not acting in an open manner, is not willing to share details of meetings with
with foreign leaders, especially
somebody like Putin, is not willing to kind of share and be open about those exchanges, then I think the trust and verify goes both ways. It, we should also trust and but verify our own political leaders as well. And if you're not seeing any evidence to verify the allegation or the assertions by President Trump that look, everything is fine, there was no interference by the Soviet or by the Russians, taking Mr. Putin's word for it, then I think we should probably look for evidence to verify that as well.
Well, it's one of the Marx brothers who always one of my go-tos. I think it was Chico who said he may be honest, but it helps to watch them.
Yeah, right.
Unfortunately, that goes for our political leadership as well as the leadership of our adversaries.
And I don't think that, and again, not to single out this administration, I think that's how healthy democracies work. And I think you know that we have a responsibility as members of a democratic nation to do the same thing with our own policymakers. That I don't want to simply trust but not verify an assertion of any political leader when it comes to things like healthcare or you know, national security or economic policy, that we should be doing the same thing. And I think we've it's difficult to do. It's time consuming. You have to educate yourself to participate in democracy. But I think that was an ideal of our founding fathers, that we were supposed to not simply vote and leave the republic to a small group of our policymakers that we don't check in on except every 4 years when we vote. I think that we're supposed to participate. And you know, to me, I think this is why the language that the current administration is using against the press is so dangerous, because I think a healthy press is part of a healthy democracy, and for an electorate to participate in democracy, you need to have good information, and oftentimes that does come from the press.
I find it interesting because, much like I often do, I go back to my founding fathers here for insights into their wisdom, and if you need to look any further, my personal favorite was Benjamin Franklin, who was one of the leading forces behind the creation of a public library system, because he understood that if our experiment in democracy were to succeed, knowledge and understanding could not be solely the purview of the wealthy amongst our society. We had to have a population overall that is well-educated and engaged. Not only engaged, but can engage critical thinking skills and challenge their own leadership. You know, when we look at it from that perspective, certainly any idea if it can't withstand scrutiny needs to be revisited. We need to rethink that. And I think that's, you know, precisely what you're saying. Now, we do see, you know, Donald Trump rallies his followers, his acolytes, if you will, with the slogan, "Make America Great Again." I always believe that this is a great nation because of the values that our founding fathers brought to us, those that they gave to us. They were inspired by the French Revolution and the liberty, equality, fraternity that revolution was founded on. Is this very notion of Donald Trump's Make America Great Again misguided? And what do you perceive as the defining characteristics of a great nation, not just a great military?
That's a big question. When I was teaching a U.S. survey course to plebes, first-year cadets at West Point, I always told them that the best way to be patriotic is to study our past critically, warts and all, and that if you look back on the past with rose-colored glasses and kind of carved out all the bad spots because you didn't want to talk about racial inequality or class inequalities or things related to Japanese internment in World War II or the slow, oftentimes faulting civil rights movement and the backlash against that movement. That if you didn't embrace that as you look back on the past, that that in a sense that wasn't being patriotic. That the only way to make the United States as a nation better is to look critically backwards and find our faults and see where we can continue to better this experiment. And so the problem, I think, with the rhetoric of Make America Great Again is that it just carves away all of the bad stuff. And we just have a very specific vision of the United States. And I'm not even sure how the president really articulates it besides a phrase. What time period was America great? I challenge this with my students, right? That, the greatest generation of Americans who fought overseas in World War II was also the generation that interred Japanese Americans. It was also a very segregated society. It was an American society that that had a whole host of problems. Now they did amazing things, both during the war and after. But we do them more honor, I think, when we look at that generation or our past holistically. In terms of values and what makes a nation great, to me, I think it's respecting the debate. And I think that's where we've clearly had a challenge over the last few years in particular, is that democracies are inherently chaotic. They're inherently argumentative. And I think when you stop respecting the debate, you start, getting into positions where I think over the last few years in particular, that words like compromise just become bad words. And that's not healthy, I think, for a democracy, that we're where the other side simply becomes an evil other inside your own nation. And that's not healthy. And I think to kind of get back to some of those, foundational ideals, from our founding fathers, again, even a flawed generation themselves, right? Right. To kind of pull the best of those threads forward and come back to them, I think is what we'll need to kind of hopefully get us back from these polarizing opposites on each side and get back to some moderation in the middle.
Right. I think there have certainly been elements of greatness mm-hmm. in every generation that America has produced, going back to our founding fathers and even prior to gaining our independence from England.
And this generation, for as much flack as young millennials get, I will tell you that the students that I've got in class here at Chapman, they're bright, they're inquisitive, they're well-intentioned, they see something besides themselves. I think you're exactly right. I think that there are elements of good in every generation. I think the challenge for all of us is to elevate those good qualities at the same time we're trying to fix some of the inherent flaws that we continue to struggle with in our system.
Right. And my approach towards elevating that generation or that discourse goes back to an adage, there's no sin in being wrong.
Right.
The sin is not correcting yourself and elevating yourself, if you will, when it becomes evident that you're mistaken or you're wrong.
Yeah. Again, I one of the things I kept coming back to when I teach the U.S. survey course was this phrase to make a more perfect union, right? And so that those are aspirational words. You're probably never going to achieve perfection. But if you can take up that challenge as an American citizen and do something, even in your own small garden, to help make a more perfect union, then that's what I think will continue to keep our democracy strong.
Well, and sometimes we do get the leadership that recognizes that. I was speaking with Gavin Newsom not too long ago, and one of the things that had the most impact on me was when he said, it's better to aim too high and fail
right.
than to aim too low and succeed.
Right, right.
So having those higher aspirations, I think, are what helps to push the ball forward. We shouldn't beat ourselves up over the fact that we don't always reach our better beings.
Right.
But if you don't have that extraordinary target out there,
right.
then you're always going to be less than you can possibly be. And sometimes you're
destined to mediocrity if you don't do that.
And sometimes you surprise yourself. Right. In psychology, we look at it from a learning standpoint as a zone of proximal development. Mm-hmm. You always want to have something which is just beyond your reach of capability, but strive towards that. Right. And I think that's what we need to do both as a nation and as a state, and certainly as individuals.
Yeah.
A few years after the Camp David Agreement was signed by Israel and Egypt, the Israeli people felt very disappointed in the peace accord between their nation and Egypt. Mm-hmm. The realization was that the opposite of peace is not necessarily making love. The opposite of peace is not making war. Is not making war the best we can hope for at this time in our history? And is there anything that we can do to move beyond this minimal outcome?
The pessimist in me says no, that I think that humans will always see the potential benefits of using force to achieve their aims. So we've had lots of discussions of this in our program at Chapman about just the inherent nature of man and does that contribute to us continuing to come back to war as an avenue for achieving your policy aims. I think we still have an immense amount of faith in the capacity for war, which I think is problematic. It seems to me that war continues to lure us with this capacity to do some good, and then it keeps disappointing us, and yet we keep coming back to it. There's almost this this unthinking faith in the capacity of war to give us something.
Well, it's certainly a lazy approach. It's an intellectually lazy approach because the heavy lifting is in diplomacy.
Right.
Because that requires understanding compromise and willing to make concessions as well.
Yeah, and I think, the Middle East complicates that just regionally in terms of religion and racial issues and, competing ideologies. And that complicates, I think, complicates pushing war to the back burner a little bit and bringing diplomacy to the forefront.
I think one of the things we often fail to see in our leadership is that there's always at play the law of unintended consequences.
Right.
So we don't recognize fully what the ramifications are, the disruptions that we can cause a society. When we went into Iraq, for example,
that's a perfect example.
Our founding fathers were children of the Enlightenment. They created a great experiment in democracy and self-governance without any model to build upon. But it seems to me that when we went into Iraq, we didn't recognize that we have a culture and a society which is several millennium old, or millennia, I suppose, is the correct. Mm-hmm. But in any case, and that they weren't going to necessarily embrace our concepts of democratic rule that we see as being so fundamental to our nation and our existence.
Yeah,
as
people. We've been struggling with this for a while. I teach one book in our course on called Modernization as Ideology, and this theory that was prevalent in the 1950s and 60s, that modernization theory, that if you just put these traditional societies, as they were called, on this path towards economic growth, that they would ultimately lead towards the end state, which was an American-inspired capitalist democracy. And come to find out that there was just a basic assumption there that all societies, traditional ones in particular, wanted to be like the United States. And that's a big assumption. And I still think we wrestle with that in terms of having a hard time understanding why nations even if we give them the opportunity to become an American-style democracy, choose something else.
Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. But before we go, I have a few final questions, if you don't mind. First and foremost, who are some of the most nefarious players on the global stage today?
I don't know if there's really an easy answer to that, right? I think it's I think the challenge of answering a question of who are the most nefarious players on the planet is really a regional approach to answering a question like that, right? That especially for the United States, if you are aspiring and are a global power, then you can't really look at the world as just a as static, you know, homogenous whole. That you've got to look at the world regionally. So who are the most nefarious characters in Asia versus Eastern Europe versus Africa versus South America? And I think that's the challenge for a global power like the United States is thinking regionally and not kind of homogenizing our approach to foreign policy. And again, I think this is why an organization like the State Department and experts in regional affairs is so important.
And certainly there's no shortage. Yeah. I mean, we have Kim Jong-un in North Korea. Mm-hmm. We have Erdogan in Turkey. Mm-hmm. You can go around the globe and right. you can certainly identify individuals and nations that pose serious threat right, to right, right. world stability right. and economic, you know, well-being across our planet.
Right. And I think, you know, this is the challenge. I think that was a lot of debate you saw in the late 90s and even into the early 2000s about the responsibility to protect. And if we, the United States is a global power, what are our responsibilities to insert ourselves into local affairs, like genocides in Rwanda in the early 1990s? Do we have a responsibility to intervene in Korea to solve some of the problems in that authoritarian regime? And so I think that's the other challenge too, is that not only identifying nefarious actors, but then deciding whether or not you're going to intervene to deal with them makes the conceptualization of foreign policy even more difficult.
Well, I'll leave us with this one final thought. Yeah. And that thought is that one day the lion will lie down with the lamb, but the lamb had better sleep with one eye open.
Right, right, right.
So with that in mind, where can our listeners go to learn more about your program at Chapman University and a little bit more about you?
I think if you just, just go to any search engine like Google and just type in Chapman War and Society, our program will come up. We've got a pretty good webpage that outlines what our program is about. We take a holistic approach to the study of the relationships between war and society. And I think we've got a lot to offer, not just locally here in Southern California, but as our program expands, hopefully to have a national, have a voice in the national at the national level in terms of our foreign policy and national security.
I want to thank you for joining me today. I also want to thank our audience for joining us. My guest today has been Dr. Greg Daddis, director of Chapman University's MA program in War and Society. Before we go, I would like to express my gratitude to the World Affairs Councils of Orange County for making today's interview possible. The Council is part of the World Affairs Councils of America, an organization of almost 100 independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan councils across the United States whose mission it is to educate, inspire, and engage our citizens in the critical global issues of our time. World Affairs Council of Orange County's members and guests are engaged citizens throughout Orange County and Southern California. The purpose of the events is to promote a better understanding of world affairs and to engage their members in becoming better informed participants in the global community. Recent speakers have included General Michael Hayden, Representative Adam Schiff, former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, and General David Petraeus. Please join Perspectives again next week. Until then, take care, everybody.